Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, the Church marks the feast of the dedication of the basilicas of Saints Peter and Paul, two of the most ancient churches in Christendom. We take a look at a bit of their history dating from the martyrdom in Rome of the two apostles. Four major basilicas each has a feast day marking its dedication, a day remembered in the Church's liturgical calendar every year. We celebrate St. Mary Major's on August 5th and St. John Lateran's on November 9th. The basilicas of St. Peter and St. Paul outside the walls are celebrated together on November 18th. Though it's not the one we see today here in Rome, St. Peter's Basilica was first erected over the tomb of the Apostle Peter by the first Christian emperor, Constantine, in the 300s. Peter was believed to have arrived in Rome around the year 40 AD, the first century, and lived here preaching and converting Jews and Roman pagans to Christianity until his death in the year 64. Peter was one of the first Christians to be rounded up and put to death by the Roman Emperor Nero, who blamed them for a horrific fire that devastated the city. The site of Peter's death and burial, an area of Rome called Vatican Hill. Construction on the basilica pilgrims can visit today was begun back in the 1500s on the order of Pope Julius II, who never lived to see it completed more than 100 years later. It was Pope Urban VIII who finally consecrated the basilica on November 18, 1626. While Veronica Scarisbrick took a walk through St. Peter's Basilica with Father Adrian Tomlinson from the Venerable English College, he's gained quite a reputation for his pilgrimage tours of the basilica.
Of course, St. Peter's is called St. Peter's for no other reason than it's built over the grave of St. Peter, the grave that's located for us today underneath the high altar.
Can we walk towards the high altar? Presumably there's something to mark the grave of St. Peter's, isn't there? There's a huge confessio, what's known as a confessio, which is a horseshoe-shaped open space in front of the altar with burning lamps around there.
That's right. The confessio takes its name not from anything to do with confession, other than the confession of Peter. Peter gave confession and witness to the life of Christ by his death, a death which ended with him being buried here on the side of Vatican Hill. It was on this site that early Christians venerated this great apostle. And when Constantine, back in 310, marched down and conquered the city of Rome, he wanted to
see an end to persecution of Christians.
Not immediately. That ended in the Edict of Milan in 313. But on his arrival in Rome, having won that Christian battle, he wanted to see what he called the trophies of the Christian God, because he accredited his victory and winning of Rome to the Christian God. He was brought here to the foot of Vatican Hill which in those days would have been outside the great circus of Caligula and Nero.
It was countryside in those days.
Of course, the circuses where people died were always outside what's called the pomerium, the great place of dwelling. But here was brought to a graveyard and shown a very small and insignificant grave, by then built into the side and marked into the side of a later grave, where the Prince of the Apostles, Peter, was buried.
But today we have a huge basilica around this, don't we?
Indeed we do. This basilica is the later basilica. Constantine himself was to excavate the entire hillside away in order to place his 4th century basilica over the tomb of Peter.
So that's where we're standing now, where I described this balustrade in a horseshoe shape. And if we look down, is that where the remains, the relics, I should say, more correctly, of St. Peter are?
It is, but one of the most common misconceptions is if we look down there, we can see this beautiful mosaic apse of Christ, the Pantocrator, the great...
With a silver urn.
With the dark silver urn, yes. Most people think the relics are in there. In fact, they're not. What's contained in that silver urn are the palliums, the black and white stole that the Holy Father and the archbishops wear around their necks. They're kept there to be kept close to the bones of Peter.
Which, and to provide a continuity, because the people who wear these stoles are the bishops of the church.
Exactly. They provide and mark the continuity and unity with the bishop, the archbishops throughout the world, with Peter represented by our Holy Father. But if we look carefully, we can see a little lamp burning there just to the right of that silver chest. And there beyond is a red porphyry marble slab. And it is beyond there that even today lay the bones and the remains of Peter.
It's not very obvious to the pilgrim that the relics lie behind this marble slab. Why not in the box?
Well, the entire box was placed here by Constantine. That was his first, if you like, monument to St. Peter. Inside his basilica, he encased the relics in this beautiful white and red porphyry marble box. It was then surrounded by these beautiful white Carrara marble columns with capitals on them. Those, in fact, today, if we look above us and up to those great balconies, we can see the two on this balcony above St. Helena, two on the balcony above each of the statues surrounding this great high altar. They are 8 of the original Constantinian columns. And just as a further point of interest, Constantine took the design from the columns of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem.
So we're going back in time in a big way.
We are going back, and those again are mirrored. If we look behind us at this great baldacchino, this great canopy above the altar, the papal altar, they're mirrored again in Bernini's creation there.
Father Adrian Tomlinson speaking there to Veronica Scarisbrick. Well, many people don't know it, but besides the tombs of St. Peter himself and many of the popes, St. Peter's basement contains a necropolis or burial ground that dates back to ancient times.
How eminently fitting that in this historic basilica, near to the site of St. Peter's tomb, the memory of your and our St. Columban should be venerated.
That was Pope Pius XII back in 1950, referring to the tomb of the 6th century Irish Saint Columban, located not far from the tomb of Peter. It was Pope Pius XII who in 1939 ordered the excavation work beneath St. Peter's Basilica to determine whether there was physical evidence of Peter's presence. The excavations, which concluded 30 years later, indicated Peter was indeed buried there, as were a group of early Christians. But they weren't the only ones. Besides being a Christian cemetery, the necropolis was home to a number of Roman pagan tombs. I spoke with Regina G., an art historian and Fulbright scholar recently here in Rome to conduct research on the tombs in the Scavi, the archaeological digs underneath St. Peter's Basilica. She told me more about them and how archaeologists discovered the exact site of the Apostle Peter's grave.
The Christian church literally rests on the shoulders of these tombs. In fact, had this church not been built, the original basilica by Constantine in the 4th century, the necropolis simply would not have survived. And the fact that it was covered up by the emperor and only uncovered in 1939 means that the state of preservation is extraordinary. It's incredibly rich for an art historian to go down and take a look and to try to see how they were used. This area was an area where people built their tombs. It was on the outskirts of the city, outside of the official pomerium where you could build. Think of the Appia Antica and those tombs that line the road. There was a similar road going across the Vatican Plain, and so it was, before it was anything else, a good location for a nice sort of ostentatious monument where people could see it.
Now, where do scholars place St. Peter's tomb?
St. Peter's tomb is literally in the line of these tombs. The tombs that I study were built around the space where the edicula, which is the earliest structure associated with the shrine of St. Peter's that survives, was built and dates to about 160 AD. If you imagine the papal altar, or if you care to, you could begin with the dome and drop a straight plumb line down, you will reach the spot eventually. It has been in the same spot since the construction of both basilicas, and it's directly below the papal altar.
So where are these pagan tombs that you are studying in relationship to St. Peter's tomb?
Think of a line running east-west, two rows of tombs, and near the western end is the tomb of St. Peter's, and the tombs I study basically flank it on either side and continue in a line further in one direction. Sort of down the nave of the current church would be a good place to imagine them.
So when Pope Pius XII was conducting those excavations down there, what did they find exactly?
These incredibly well-preserved, and people say catacombs, and I've actually had classical archaeologists say, oh, you're studying the catacombs, and I have to correct them and say, no, these tombs were originally above the ground. They were freestanding. They were beautiful chambers. They had doors and windows.
So in other words, they were like little houses or something.
They look extraordinarily like modern little houses, actually, almost like a row of tract housing, because they're right next to each other and they're very similar in their appearance. They are beautifully decorated inside. Mosaic floors, elaborate painting, beautiful stucco work, and Constantine's builders did do some damage. As I said earlier, the reason they survived is that the emperor used these tombs as the support for the floor of the first basilica. So when they filled them up with dirt and moved some things around, there was damage, but compared to the other tombs from the same period, these are in great shape. These were very expensive monuments. The people who own them, to judge by the inscriptions, were an interesting group. They were mostly former slaves who made a great deal of money. And they wanted
former to slaves?
Yes. Former slaves. They were freedmen. We call them libertini as a class. And they went from owned property to owners of property, and they wanted to communicate that fact. They became Roman citizens. So there was the proud display of the Trianomia, the three names that mean I'm a Roman citizen now. Part of the material display was because they wanted to communicate the change in status, absolutely.
How many tombs did you say that the excavators eventually found there under the basilica?
They were able to uncover 22, most of which you can enter, some you cannot. There's almost no doubt that it went on to the east and the west, but it would be dangerous to the fabric of the church to continue.
Now, how do you explain the mixture of pagan tombs with Christian tombs down there?
Well, these tombs had a long history. They're dated to about 125 to 170, and they ended their life, as it were, with the covering up by Constantine. Towards the end of this period, in other words, right before Constantine essentially rendered them functionless to build the basilica, there's evidence of reuse. That's a long time, and so families die out. There might even be people who squatted, you know, who moved into empty tombs because they wanted to be close to Peter. Some of the families may have become Christian, or it may just be a new family. It's difficult to tell, but what you see is inscriptional evidence that makes it clear that now we're dealing with Christians. And perhaps the most interesting example is a small tomb called Tomb M by the excavators that was clearly originally pagan, belonged to the Julia family, and a small child was buried there about a year old. And it was redecorated completely with Christian mosaics near the end of its existence. In that tomb, we have one of the earliest images of Christ. He looks like the god Helios, but he has a cross instead of rays of sun. We have Jonah and the whale and the Good Shepherd in there. So that's a good example of reuse by Christians of these tombs. But if you look in the other tombs, there's Bacchus and Isis and Hercules and Aphrodite.
What evidence did these scholars find to prove that Peter was down there?
Well, the physical evidence of the Edicula, the building that was found, that dates to 160, it does look like a funerary monument. There is also evidence in the form of a graffito from the 2nd century on this shrine that it's in Greek and it's fragmentary. It definitely has Peter's name on it, and one very eminent scholar named Guarducci has interpreted it to say Peter is within. And what it shows is very early on, before Constantine, almost less than two generations after the martyrdom of Peter, there was a strong belief by the Roman Christian community that this was the actual site of his burial. And that's very early and very continuous. There's never been a suggestion that he was elsewhere. There's sort of an unbroken line of belief, which, considering how early it started, is very compelling.
The Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul, January 25th, marks the end of the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity every year. Ecumenical celebrations are traditionally held each year at the Rome Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls. That's not far west from the Vatican. Well, the shrine itself celebrates its dedication on November 18th each year, together with its sister cathedral, St. Peter's. Both basilicas date back to the period of the Emperor Constantine. St. Paul's was destroyed by fires and rebuilt over hundreds of years. The new basilica we can visit today was consecrated on December 10, 1854, by Pope Pius IX. Centuries ago, the original basilica was built over the tomb of the Apostle Paul. While Peter's burial place can be seen underneath St. Peter's Basilica, the Apostle Paul's had been hidden from view. But after recent excavations underneath St. Paul's Basilica, pilgrims can finally catch a glimpse of the Apostle's tomb. The rough-hewn marble sarcophagus dates back to the time of Constantine in the 4th century. And has been buried in concrete and under tons of rubble beneath the basilica. Well, I asked Professor of Christian Art and Architecture Elizabeth Lev why the Basilica of St. Paul's is called Outside the Walls, and how Paul came to live and die here in Rome.
Because the name of the church comes from the fact that the basilica is built outside of the ancient Roman city walls. In 271, Rome had a series of, today you can still see this intact series of walls, which spans an 11-mile circuit. The Rome of Paul's age in the 60s was an even smaller circuit of walls. And the Church of St. Paul, when it was eventually built by Constantine, was built outside the city walls on the site where St. Paul had been buried. And so it's referred to as the Church of St. Paul outside the walls, whereas there are churches to St. Paul within the city walls.
It's quite symbolic, too, it seems to me, that both St. Peter's and St. Paul's are on the same side of the Tiber River.
In both cases, I think even more interesting is the way they are spread directly opposite from each other. So if the Romans always construct their cities with what they call the Cardo and the Decumanus, these are two main roads, so they're the lifeline, and there's this intersection between the two roads. The churches of St. Peter and St. Paul, they make really the Cardo of Rome, the two balances that define and shape the city. And so it is a very interesting aspect of the construction.
Now, why would St. Paul's bones have been buried there? What kind of a life did he have in Rome? We know the story, especially from Caravaggio's painting in Santa Maria del Popolo, of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, who is blinded by the revelation of God. Tell us more about the life of St. Paul and how he must have lived here in Rome.
Well, St. Paul's conversion was extraordinary in every way. He went from being one of the harshest persecutors of Christians. He was a Jew. He was also a Roman citizen, though, by nature of his birth. He was freeborn as a Roman citizen, which will give him opportunities and possibilities which will not be available to St. Peter, who is not a Roman citizen. And St. Paul started our first mention of Paul is with his earlier name of Saul, persecutor of Christians, eager to go to Damascus to bring other Christians for punishment and persecution. And God's interruption in his life, Christ's revelation to him in Saul, why do you persecute me? Blinded, helped, assisted, reborn, if you will, he becomes Paul, and he travels all over the Mideast. He goes up through the Hellenistic world. He goes to Greece. He goes to Anatolia. He goes from place to place, forming these pockets of Christians, and then he comes to Rome. And he comes to Rome as a prisoner, because when Paul was brought up for trial, when he was condemned, Paul, as a Roman citizen, had the right of appeal directly to the Roman emperor, which is exactly what plays right into the hands of the Christian plan to bring Christianity to Rome. So Paul was brought to Rome. At the time, according to the legends, the Emperor Nero was not overly interested in the problem of the Christians yet. And so Paul lived in a kind of house arrest in rented rooms for about 2 years, during which time he was able to freely communicate, evangelize, preach. Whether or not he took trips from Rome, things start to get shaky. So we know that Paul lived, he lived at least 2 years here in Rome, because it's in the Acts of the Apostles. There are a number of different areas in Rome that claim, you know, Paul slept here, but we know he lived in rented lodgings, and that Paul was able to, from Rome, he wrote several of his letters, and of course before he came to Rome, he wrote the longest of his letters, which is the letter to the Romans.
Am I correct in recalling that there is a site in the Roman Forum that used to be a prison, and some of the apostles were held there?
Paul's life here in Rome, gradually the net grew closer as Nero's madness grew deeper. The catalyst, according to tradition, was the Great Fire of Rome. And tradition has it that,
which was in the, what, 50s?
64 A.D., mm-hmm. There was the Great Fire of Rome, which knocked out 10 of the 14 quarters of the city. The rumors that flew at the time were that Nero himself had set the fire because he wanted to build in the area. But Nero turned around and blamed the Christians for the fire. And this is documented. Tacitus tells us that that Nero claimed the fire was set by these pernicious Christians, this Jewish cult that followed a man named Crestus. So we see that the Christians are really they're in line for the first major persecution in Rome. Now, the tradition is that St. Peter and St. Paul were both in Rome in 64. As a matter of fact, we think that Paul came to Rome somewhere 60, 62, and that Peter had already been in Rome for many years after he left Antioch. And so that Peter and Paul were rounded up in the repercussions for the fire, and they were put in prison together, in the political prison right off the Forum, known as the Mamertine Prison. Whether or not that is true or can be archaeologically supported is a whole different question. But what is very, very beautiful, and one of the most lovely things, I think you know this because you and I have both lived in Rome for quite a long time, is June 29th, which celebrates the day that the two apostles were taken from their prison. So many paintings of the two embracing for one last time, and Peter marched in the direction that would later become St. Peter's, and St. Paul marched over towards the sea, and he would be executed at the site of the Tre Fontane, which still has a monastery and church on it. And
the Three Fountains.
The Three Fountains.
Why is it called the Three Fountains?
It's a legend. These wonderful legends around the deaths of the apostles, particularly Paul, has a series of magnificent legends surrounding his death. That the head of Paul was beheaded. It's his right as a Roman citizen as well, to a swift death, as opposed to Peter, who was going to be crucified. And that Paul was led out. He was bent down, he was beheaded, and his head, when severed, bounced three times. In each place his head bounced, a fountain sprung up. And so this is the site of the Three Fountains.
Which is an actual church now. There,
which is today an actual church on the Laurentina with three fountains, which have mosaic flooring from an earlier period than when Paul died. But it's still a beautiful place to go and a wonderful place to remember the witness of Paul. And then the body of Paul was taken a few kilometers down, a little ways down, to where the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls is today. Although a section of the skull was removed at some point, again, in the very early era of the relics, you know that the bodies of the apostles were moved around a bit because of persecutions, because of later date, because of other problems. So, for example, in the catacombs of St. Sebastian, there's the room of the apostles where Peter and Paul were allegedly kept together. Their remains were kept together in a safer place. And in the Church of St. John Lateran, the huge reliquary over the main altar, the papal altar of St. John Lateran, the reliquary contains a piece of the skull of Peter and a piece of the skull of Paul. But I trust the rest of Paul will be in the sarcophagus. Mm-hmm. You know that the description of the grave of St. Peter comes from a man named Caius, who left us a written description of the grave of St. Peter and says he saw the tombs of St. Peter and St. Paul. And so it's good to know that there is a document. There's a document that dates from about 200 AD, and he was writing a sort of an apologetics, a kind of defensive letter. And in the midst of it, he says, "I can show you the trophies of St. Peter and St. Paul." So we know in 200, before Christianity is legalized, before they're building churches, we already have a document that testifies to veneration of the relics of the martyrs, won out by the Tre Fontane, out by the Ostiense road, and the other one on the Vatican Hill.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture for Duquesne University's Rome campus. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.